There'll be eruptions in.
Okay, we're recording.
Okay, so the basic premise is that I grew up at the beginning, or not the beginning, yeah, really, I was kind of born at the beginning of the space age, as far as, you know, going to the moon and all that stuff like that. Kind of grew up with it. I always figured that, you know, by the time I was, you know, 30-something, be living in space, go to the moon, be basically living inside the solar system. So, waiting for, I actually went to University of Alaska Fairbanks. They had a rocket program there, because they had their own launch facilities. Poker Flats, they launched sounding rockets, mainly for studying the aurora borealis. They have a bunch of high-energy physics studies up there. They had some actually leading professors plasma physics at the university. So, fully expecting, you know, that we'd enter the space age, and nothing really happened. Granted, we got like computers and technology and things like that, the World Wide Web, and we made some big surprises, but some of the things hadn't happened, and I'm really disappointed in NASA. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is like, well, maybe I shouldn't have took hold of all these, you know, these ideas that we had and kept them to ourselves. Maybe we should have put them out there and tried to do them ourselves rather than waiting for somebody else to do things. And right now in our society, we're actually kind of having that kind of culture come into place with hacker spaces and maker spaces and open source. I mean, started with Linux as being open source, and people starting to collaborate and build these bigger systems that everybody can use for really inexpensive. And started to realize that maybe we could do that basically to get ourselves into space. One of the things. So I guess I don't have my notes yet. We'll be here in a minute. It looks like. But one of the things. There's several companies are already doing that rather than waiting for NASA. And NASA's basically dropped the ball. You know, we have a shuttle that's not, you know, non-functional basically, or is on its way out. SpaceX has stepped up to the plate and is going to be, you know, basically providing, you know, support missions to the International Space Station. The Russians have been doing it for some time already, and there's several other companies that are providing services to get basically tourism to space. The XPRIZE, it was one of them, with Scaled Composites built Spaceship One and basically won the XPRIZE. And they used, the rocket motor that they used was built by a company called SpaceDev, who actually I had stock in for a while, that they built this really simple to use engine, which was really extremely safe, environmentally sound, all these really good things about it. So they're already building packages of technology that other companies can use relatively inexpensively compared to what, you know, billions of dollars, you know, to get things into orbit. And then, so there's other companies that are coming down the pike the same way. So Scaled Composites licensed their technology to Richard Branson. Now Richard Branson is doing launches into not low Earth orbit per se, but basically joyrides, you know, to 200,000 feet, or 200K, right, kilometers. And they're also talking about doing orbitals, maybe by bringing basically a rocket up there and shooting the rocket from there by using the same technology. So we're kind of already moving away from having the government do these things for us, which I think is good, because it's always been, I mean, out of reach for the average citizen. It still probably is, because, you know, $200,000 just to spend 15 minutes. I mean, it'd be great, but if I was going to spend $200,000, I'd want to basically move into space and actually live up there. So, let me get my web connection here, and I can show a video here real quick in a minute, and then kind of hit a couple of the points, and then I'll probably just open it up to kind of discussion, because I really want to get some other people's input on some of these ideas, because I think, like I said, it's going to have to be a collaborative effort, I think, on basically everybody's part who's interested in these sorts of things, to make make it happen. Otherwise, it's just going to take forever.
Can you go over some of the
I can go over some of my information. Unfortunately, it's a little bit antiquated. I don't know a lot of details about some of the new stuff. I mean, hard details, but I do know some of the basic stuff. And I apologize again for being late. Not much stuff, but here we are. We're going now. Mm-hmm. 90 seconds here.
So while Larry's pulling that up, I'll ask a really quick question, just to play devil's advocate. Why do we need to go to space?
There's two good questions. Okay, so there's a why, and then there's a how. The how is not really so much as important as the why, and maybe not as difficult even. Werner von Braun said back at the beginning of the space age, he said, you know, they interviewed him, and they asked him, you know, how will man? First of all, will man ever go to the moon, or will they go out there? And they kind of expected him to say, you know, oh, we'll do it this way. You know, how will we do it? And they expected him to say these things like, oh, well, you know, this much of mass versus propellant and all that stuff like that. And what he said was, man's will alone will take him there. And it's not really will alone, I think, but You gotta have a reason why, and that is a good thing. That's good to discuss. I've got several points of why. One that I've, and this is kind of in the middle of the list, but I'll go ahead and put it out there anyway. Right now, if we do something to our environment right now, we usually don't see it. It'll take 10, 20 years, 30 years, who knows how long, before we pollute our atmosphere long enough that we'll start seeing the effects, cancer rates, and all these other problems. The air will get unbreathable. You'll see, you know, asthma and all this other stuff come into play. If you were in an enclosed environment and you lit a trash can on fire, in a matter of minutes, you'd be wanting to get the hell out of there. You'd know that you screwed up your environment. So I think that closed ecosystems that are a very important part of understanding, I mean, how our Earth and how our systems work. And that's one of the things I basically propose, is that before we even move into space, we need to get some stuff straight here, but we can still do that at the same time. One of the things that I'd like to see is like biospheres. So what you can do is you take a biosphere, they have the Eden Dome, which is in the UK. It's a large enclosed space, and they open it up so they get fresh air and stuff like that. But basically, it's enclosed. You can completely enclose a space for relatively cheap, and then you can do whatever you want with the environment in there. You could grow whatever plants. You can grow tropical things in a non-tropical environment. You can completely close it off and start seeing actually what happens when you bump the CO2 up and see what kind of things succeed and what kind of things fail. We can do things like that. I've always looked at that as a stepping stone on to get us to living in habitats in space, but there's no reason why you can't use that tech, and you shouldn't do that technology here, because it's a hell of a lot easier to step out the door when things go wrong than it is to, you know, try to get an escape pod and go someplace else, because you're probably, you know, might not make it, which is okay, because it's a risky endeavor. And I think that's another thing that we've kind of lost track of. I mean, when our society has kind of stopped taking risks. I mean, back in the age of exploration, I mean, people would load up on a boat and go someplace, and some died and some didn't. Granted, nobody wants to die, but I mean, I'd take a risk. And somebody said, hey, take me to Mars, 50% chance of life or death, I'd take it. I'd do it. Even if, you know, being, this is a transhumanist group, so even with the chance of the possibility of living forever, I think it's a, you know, or a long period of time, 100 years, however long, with medical technology, I would still take the risk, yes.
I'm not an issue expert, so why exactly did those people back then go on a boat?
He's probably finally got the things.
Go on a boat and go
Money?
Well, yeah, that's a that's a good reason. Are there any other reasons?
It's curiosity.
Anybody else a history professor? Or history?
I just was under the impression that people got on the boats for a better opportunity of many kinds, so monetary, the possibility of having a better life.
In a place that they've never been.
Yeah, what point, I guess, what point in history are we talking about? Are we talking about...
So, I know that the first explorers, like Columbus, yes, and all those other ones, actually.
Trade route.
For trade route and for gold, money, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and then the second wave would be the ones to settle.
Colonize.
Mm-hmm. So where are we? Are we on the first wave? Is there money out in space?
The first one to land on an asteroid and claim it for themselves will be a trillionaire.
But can they bring that?
It's very
convert that into anything that matters. Can it?
Yeah, it depends whether they can transport the stuff back somewhere where somebody's going
to
use it.
Right. If just taking it, bringing it to Earth, you're a trillionaire. I wouldn't even bring it to Earth. There's no real reason why. I would provide raw materials to build stuff in orbit or the moon, anywhere the L points. To get things to the planet is actually pretty easy, because when you melt things in a zero gravity, fairly easy to do. Take a large parabolic mirror, focus it on a point, and it's going to melt it in that spot. And then also the way that generally things work is you get some, what's it called, surface tension. So it has a tendency to ball up and form in these spots. So that part's kind of easy. If you add air to something like that, it actually makes foam. So let's say that you wanted to make this is way off topic from what I was talking about. But so you can make foam materials really easy in space. So if you got, let's say it was iron or other kind of raw materials, you can basically foam that metal. And so now it's going to be very lightweight. You could actually make like a foam like shuttle like structure, put little control surfaces on it, and then push it towards, push it with a little bit of propellant and basically land it anywhere on the planet. I mean, it would be fairly easy to develop these sorts of systems.
Has anybody done an experiment to make this kind of foam?
Kind of what?
Foam in zero G.
I'm not sure. It's just it's a lot easier to do things like that up there. I mean, you can make foam stuff down here. It's just that metal is not, it's kind of difficult to do in a regular, in a gravity, because it has a tendency to settle.
Hey, Lime.
Okay, so now I have this I can bring. Okay, so. So where is this? Okay, so a why. Why would you want to go? One of the main reasons, money would be one. I mean, but my main reason is that if something happens here to this planet, that's it. I mean, if an asteroid comes, you think we can stop it? I doubt it.
It's the same idea as your enclosed small space, and it's safer to do here because you could just step out of the door.
Exactly.
And so if we already have space travel under control, then if things go wrong here, it's just a matter of stepping out of the door.
Well, yeah, but you couldn't rescue everybody. But if you were already in space and you were already mining asteroids, the odds of you knowing that one's going to hit us is probably pretty good, because it's valuable. I mean, that's valuable. It's a valuable commodity. Mm-hmm. Especially one that's going to be big enough to do major damage to the planet. And I'm not saying if this will happen, it'll be when it'll happen, because after a period of time, eventually it will happen. And if our civilization fails for some reason, and we take another 1,000 or 10,000 years to get back up there, I mean, we might make it, but we might not. We don't know. There's a couple of rocks that are coming pretty close that are probably not going to hit us. But they would be really easy to get on if we decided just to go. I mean, we could land a probe on them really easy. If somebody wanted to stake a claim and put a robot on it, there's no reason why they couldn't. More countries, well, China is they're starting to get more into things. India's already launched some stuff. So more and more countries. That's the problem with countries. Hello. That's right. So the problem with countries, I think, is that I would like to see private organizations do more things, because right now there's hardly any, there's not that many launches that go on right now. And I think that we need to have more of an evolutionary system. And when I show this video, it'll kind of explain the concept behind this.
You don't see any inherent problems with privatizing space?
There could be some. I think that the risks far outweigh. I mean, somebody's going to do it anyway. So it's already kind of anybody can do. I mean, right now, if you want to put something in space, you have to get an export license from the United States. You got to get an export license to launch something. So it's kind of silly. If you're living and working up there, it's much better, I think, than just waiting for some company to go off and do it. I'd rather that we do it collectively rather than...
So you're not necessarily for the privatization, you're just for the not waiting for the government sweep
Not
have
waiting
in
for the
town.
Government, not waiting for a corporation.
Okay.
Lockheed Martin's actually thinking about doing stuff mining stuff. So, I mean, sure, you want the people who want, make war, make...
Well, I mean, that was my point, because you keep talking about businesses and people staking a claim. That's sort of a private sector, and that's going to... I feel like there's inherent problems in that. Well, it's... I mean, if we're talking about space as a way to sort of leave this planet and explore space, if private corporations are the one that control that export, then it's going to be a lot more difficult for regular people to go out there. It would be a lot easier if it was a government-sponsored thing. If the government saw merit in that and put that together, which they don't.
Oops, sorry.
But,
so,
hello.
If you're talking about open source instead of the previous two suggestions, the question is, how does an open source organization get enough money to start with?
One of the things... these are kind of small steps right now. Right now there are, there's been several balloon launches up to the edge of space right now. So I guess recently, news is that a couple MIT students, or basically kids, got a balloon, took pictures all the way up, all the way in, all the way down, $150
mm-hmm.
to put a balloon and get camera footage.
Lab here in Seattle, HackerBot.
They've done this too.
Put a balloon up, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the costs were. I think it might.
I don't know either.
I was looking at, and it's probably maybe a couple thousand, but $150. Somebody at MIT, some kids did.
Yeah.
So, that's obviously not to orbit and things like that. But that's the kind of things, thinking outside the box, that's probably gonna kind of get us there. And this is not about. This video is not really about getting us per se into space. There's other organizations that are kind of talked about this, but this is kind of a, I think this is a cool idea. This guy right here about what is kind of wrong with the way we're doing things now. I think they're going on the right track, but.
It has been almost 4 decades since Apollo 11 and something's wrong. Weren't people supposed to have walked on Mars by now? A mature space industry has developed, but it's mainly large-scale infrastructure. Everything is so expensive. Each launch seems to be a years-long project. There's little opportunity for direct involvement in space exploration.
Google Talk, this is about an hour-long talk. He goes into basically how to set up and do small cell phone-sized microsatellites that you could distribute throughout the solar system, basically here to Mars, relatively inexpensively. Launches being actually in, huh?
As long as you don't try and land it on anything.
Well, no, you can try to land it too. There's the thing is that once you start, if your things are inexpensive, and you can start experimenting and using basically an evolutionary pathway where things are don't cost that much, and then if they fail, it's not that big of a thing. But it only costs hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars to put a small satellite into orbit. They have CubeSats and they have CanSats. So you've been talking about doing, which are like the size of a beer can, that you can put in orbit relatively inexpensively. And mainly you don't want to have it in orbit because there's already too much junk in orbit anyway. But you want to go out and away to look at things. That's something that can be within reach of your average, average person.
Are people worried about pollution in space with all these?
There is in orbit, and especially low Earth orbit, there's large amount of debris, and that's just going to get worse. And that's one of the other things that that we kind of are in a time for a window where one thing hits something else, and it scatters a large amount of debris, and then it's going to cause havoc. It's a bad area to get into.
I actually looked into launching CubeSats. Which are essentially either a 10 centimeter cube satellite up to a 10 by 10 by 30 satellite. And part of the deal with launching these into low Earth orbit, part of the process for getting permission to launch them up there is that you have to have basically a plan to deorbit them. Like essentially get them into low enough orbit that it'll decay rapidly enough that everything will come down. What's up?
I learned at a talk about actual space exploration at the recent science fiction convention in Portland that every large-scale satellite operator that has ever put a satellite into orbit has put not applicable on that line of the form. We're not going to bother deorbiting if we're going to be using it forever. I don't know, something like that.
It's probably geocentric or...
No, I'm talking about everyone.
Oh, really?
That's what they said.
That's cool.
And that's why it's the way it is now.
Well,
I think that's particular to, you're right, I think that's particular to CubeSat. The larger ones, probably that's true, but CubeSats are special.
Or they're not special enough. They don't have you don't have connections with the people who will let you do that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. CubeSat is, they're under the aegis of a certain organization, so they do, they've got a little bit more strict guidelines, because generally CubeSats are secondary satellites, and so, like, a big satellite will pay for a launch, and there will be extra payload, and so they have to, like, really vet these secondary satellites, because basically... If you screw up the primary guy, then like you get blacklisted forever. So there's somewhat more stringent guidelines on that sort of thing. Yes. In fact, I don't think that there's ever been a successful entry into low Earth orbit without rockets.
Yeah, and that also by having that vetting process, that might help prevent. That seems to me that it's something more associated more with either privatization or with open sourcing and not with corporations and government, where it's like, well, we'll worry about that later. I don't know, maybe that's...
I'm talking about vetting, like, making sure that there's no gases that
emit
from it. I mean,
because they're much more worried about the overall impact, even if it's worry about themselves being able to... Never mind, I'm not composing myself thoughts well. It's okay. It makes sense up here. Let me process for a while.
Okay.
So these tiny satellites, have many of them been launched so far?
On the order of hundreds of CubeSats, I think.
I don't think there's that many. There's been hundreds built, but there's only been like dozens actually launched.
Okay.
And what do they do?
Various things. This guy that we talked earlier mentioned that they're great top coffee table satellites, because that's usually where they sit, unfortunately, because because you can't get them launched because there's not enough launch facilities to get them up there.
What various things do they do?
Testing. I mean, so you can do, I don't know what kind of testing, but...
I'm actually really impressed with the CubeSat platform.
Oh,
so,
me too. It's great.
There's one of the like big examples for CubeSat that they've got. Someone launched something called QuakeSat, which is actually a satellite that goes around the Earth and it monitors earthquakes. And it like gets a bunch of data and it beams it back to Earth. And I mean it's a fully working research satellite. Obviously. With small electronics and things like that.
And it doesn't cost, $20 million or whatever to build something like this. These are, you could order one of these kits, these platforms online. I think the development kit is like $10,000 or something like that. It's not that, I think it's like, oh my God, that's expensive. But,
Comparative.
These systems are, I mean, it's not, I mean, And that, you gotta realize that that's right now. That's like saying, oh, like 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you had to buy a mainframe was $10,000. Well, now, you know, your cell phone can outperform that mainframe right now. So these things are gonna go down.
How much does it cost to launch it into space? Put it in space?
That is, you gotta get a ride with somebody else. Like Theo is right now.
So I think there's a few people who are developing, like, essentially small rockets that are designed to launch one CubeSat up into space. And so, like, you would be, you know, the person doing the launch.
Go ahead. I was going to say, couldn't you launch it off a balloon? I mean, if we're sending balloons up to near orbit, couldn't you package a small rocket to get it the rest of the way?
You got to get it into orbit, and there's a bit of difficulty to get enough speed and power to get it from that to go fast enough. I mean, you can
Mach
actually...
Mach 16 or so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of work.
I think it's on a balloon and release it, it'll fall back down.
Yeah. There's no reason why you couldn't just put it on a balloon and let it sit up there for however long it'll stay up there. That'd be great, I think. There's another place that I thought I just read that they would put something in orbit for you, one of the CubeSats or small satellites, for like $8,000.
There's no way.
And I would have to find that. I just kind of remembered that. So I'm not sure what that all was. I think it was part of a larger launch thing.
Okay.
So has anybody sold data from these research things to like NASA's Mission to Planet Earth program or something?
And that'd be great. That's a great idea. I don't know. That would be one of the things. It's like, oh, could you make money doing this? Maybe you couldn't. I don't know.
What kind of stuff on it actually? I'm most curious about how they do
earthquake sensor. That's great.
I just happen to know about that. I mean, there's a variety of things.
I know that there's one that a CubeSat that they're deploying a solar sail to actually try to see if they can increase their low orbit basically and bring it up. There's another one off the top of my head. There's these tether systems where they take a tether that then run electricity through it and use a magnetic field of the Earth to basically try to boost your orbit. Something like that could be developed. You can do some serious small-scale testing of technologies for relatively inexpensive, you know, rather than having to spend, you know, like I said.
It makes a lot more sense now that everything get our electronics so small, we can make it more efficient by launching the small packages instead of those giant space shuttles.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I'm not sure how much you guys talked about private corporations and things like that going into space. But I think that it's...
Probably an asteroid mining operation would have to be a company of some kind.
Well,
workers cooperative.
Good luck.
So I read a little bit about reasons why people would want to go to space at all. I mean, not necessarily people, but I mean just... why robots or launches would want to go to space at all. And I mean, if you look at it even from the government side, right, like everyone who's going to space is doing mining. You're either bringing back, I don't know, you're either bringing back valuable stuff or you're essentially mining federal government grants. I mean, there's really no other way to do it because it's so expensive. But I guess one of the interesting things about the moon in particular is that it has a lot of helium-3 on it, which is actually extremely valuable.
Oh, would be if we had fusion working. Yeah,
it's getting pretty close. There's a couple companies. Livermore Labs is actually, they've got one that looks very promising that they built for. How much was it? It was like $2 million grant.
So are we 10 years
out
for commercial feasibility instead of 20?
No,
it's
the other thing.
It's a different something.
So there's three approaches that I'm aware of.
The big one, which is costs fusion 40 years away.
It doesn't really matter. It's just
that
there's expensive, valuable stuff.
It's something ridiculous like $100,000 a kilo or something, which is actually enough to fund a reasonable amount of private type launches, but
If anybody's seen the movie about this, Moon, don't tell me the ending.
I haven't seen it.
Good trip.
I'm interested to hear how people feel about... I remember reading a very interesting exchange online over terraforming Mars. And basically on the same principle of, well, if we're going to do it, we have to start now. But what if we're just fucking up something else? Like, what if we're just ruining another planet?
It's not a bad idea. I think that there's... living inside of a gravity well is not my idea of the best time.
Well, I mean, not even as a place to live, but as an experiment in how we handle...
I think we should study it first a little bit, figure out what exactly it is before we go messing around with it and try to terraform it. But I really don't see any problem with that, because we do it here. I mean, we level mountains, Denny Hill here. I mean, wherever we move, we make it ours.
Yeah,
so it's going to happen
do
anyway.
Do we really want to start that trend?
I really don't see any reason why. Yeah, I think that we would do much better by building space habitats and actually living in space. Because there's a hell of a lot more space up there.
There
and you
is.
Can go anywhere in the solar system really easily. It's hard to get off the planet. Once you get off the planet, you can go almost anywhere else really easily. It's not that difficult.
Did they find... back to the moon. Did they find a bunch of water on the moon? They're blowing a hole in the moon project.
A couple of things. They actually found two sources. One of them was that they did find water in the in one of the craters in the holes. Right. The other thing that they didn't realize that they surprising where they found water, and they think they went back and analyzed other data, is that you get these high energy particles that come from the sun. And so they're finding hydrogen basically embedded in the regolith. And there's already lots of oxygen. So all you have to do is liberate that and burn it, and you've got water. So it's really, it's all over the place, basically, which is very fairly recent. It's like, oh, why didn't I look for that before? It's like, duh. I mean, it really makes a lot of sense. I mean, all hydrogen is high-energy protons come streaming from the sun, from the solar wind, and they hit, and they stick. And
grab an electron from someone, and you're done.
Exactly. And that's what we're talking about. This is a little off-topic, but the Livermore nuclear, the one they're doing, is that they're doing direct, their fusion, is they're using heavier elements, and it's basically liberating a high-energy proton, which basically creates a direct electric current, so there's no neutrons, there's no pollution other than hard X-rays. So it's very, it's very safe compared to having a Tomahawk, which releases neutrons, which causes Tomahawk nuclear reactors.
Huge gobs of plasma, like, stabilized with a magnetic field.
I mean, that sounds great, but there's other ways
that's
to do
safer
it.
Than it sounds.
I know, yeah.
Until the power goes out.
Yeah.
No, then it disperses well.
So, I actually got my notes up here, so now I can...
Yeah, no problem.
I'll hit these real quick, and then... So, why? Natural and or man-made disasters. Asteroid impacts, global warming, war. Nuclear war, I grew up with that.
That would be hard to escape if you're just living in a glass dome somewhere on the Earth.
Pollution, overpopulation, lack of resources. Why is backup for the Earth. If you live, it's like you back up your data, we should back up. you should back us up because...
And that's a reason to terraform Mars. Actually.
Well, no, I think we should live in space, personally. I think that it's a lot easier, and there's other... I mean, I can go over that in a minute, too. Terraforming, sure. I mean, we can play God. That's okay. We do it here, so why not do it someplace else? But there's better places. There's actually a planetoid in the asteroid belt, and it'd be probably a much better place to go than Mars. It's further out, but there's already water there. It's frozen. You'd probably want to use nuclear power there because you could gather enough sunlight with a mirror, but nuclear is probably the way to go with something like that. So, okay. Technology improvements, because with the computer age, fuel cells, this all came from basically going to the moon. solar panels. These technologies came from our space exploration, which came from rockets, because we wanted to blow up people on the other side of the planet with our big bombs. So, I mean, let's see. Oops.
The thing I'd argue is that they're already trying to milk out space for a long time. Like when Challenger blew up, they thought that, I've heard reports that they may have put the teacher on board to kind of distract from the fact that they were trying to ramp up SDI. So,
that's not a reason why.
I'm not in favor of it, but it might be happening anyway.
It will happen eventually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with all the valuable stuff that we're talking about in space, how else would we deal with space pirates?
That's actually a question I had. Why hasn't anybody pirated space,
yeah.
I guess?
Exactly.
Were you at the Space Elevator Conference?
if we need
space
all these...
Elevator.
It makes so much sense that you do your DIY.
There was a presentation out there that was
jumpers, you know?
Ostensibly,
I mean, really,
about space pirates,
but
wasn't
it? These things probably will happen.
On the same idea of space piracy, I think that our view of space in general and what's out there is very different than how we usually view property. And I think that part of the allure of doing open source space exploration and community space exploration is that it remains sort of open for anyone who wants to be a part of it. Whereas if it's about privatization and even about government, it becomes about staking a claim, and then you have to go further and further away from base.
Guns or bigger guns.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a really interesting view of property. And how when most of us, at least when I was growing up and hearing about space, we never talked about, well, we're going to, you know, we were the first on the moon, so now the moon belongs to America. That was never,
yeah.
That was never talked about, even though it's kind of explicit in planting a flag there.
But
well, do you have a flag?
Works.
You know?
A few comments. I found out that actually someone has claimed all of the mineral rights to the moon, which has apparently been semi-ratified by the UN. I'm not really sure how, like, legit this is, but the guy is, like, selling subclaims and stuff, and he's got a bunch of paperwork, so I don't know what the deal is with that. About terraforming Mars, I am deeply skeptical. Mars is hemorrhaging atmosphere, and it doesn't have much of a magnetic field to protect it from high-energy particles.
You need a space.
Yeah.
Yes,
you know?
And it won't happen.
But so the problem is that bacteria have a hard time living where there's lots of high energy particles striking the ground.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's kind of, unless you want like people on the ground for, I don't know, however many hundreds or thousands of years doing the terraforming.
That's how long it takes.
I think that that might be somewhat difficult to do.
No doubt.
There's better ways to do it. It's better to do, like I said, an enclosed environment. One of the books I read about 10 years ago, there's something called the Millennial Project. And let's see, what's the subtext of that is how to colonize a galaxy in 8 easy steps.
Oh, right.
And
I should probably read that.
It was really good. I mean, there's some really good stuff, and they started a foundation, and they ran into some tax problems. Now, evidently, they're back on the web again. It looks like it's 2.0 now, so I don't know. And I went to one of their meetings. They sounded interesting. But first, they were going to move on to the ocean, and then they were going to build launch systems there, and then get into orbit, and then do all these other things. And all this stuff is, I mean, there's some pretty sound science in there, especially I like... the way that they decided to build habitats is they built inflatable structures, and then you fill them full of water. Because once you get to space, radiation is going to be a problem. If you're in low Earth orbit, it's not such a big problem because our magnetic field protects us from most of the radiation. So, and also the atmosphere as well. Our atmosphere is about equivalent to 30 feet of water? Yeah, 10 meters, 30 feet of water. So if you had a big bubble, basically, and filled 30 feet of water on the outside of it, you were inside of it, it'd be like you were basically at the bottom, you'd be like standing on the Earth as far as your radiation protection. So these are the kind of habitats that would be great to live in space, because you could have 60 feet of water if you wanted to in some locations, but you have 30 feet of water. Not only would it protect you from radiation, but it also protect you from other micrometeorite fragments that would hit, especially people like layered 30 feet, like basically bladders, like here's one and here's one, they overlap and build like a shell around you. If it hit it, it would just, because it's hard to hurt water. It's going to vaporize a piece of water or whatever. And then you'll have a leak that comes out, and you could probably figure a way to fix that. So there's lots of ways to...
Would that be ice by then, or...?
Depending. What you'd want to do is... you'd probably want to do some sort of either shield... Well, not shielding, but shield it from the sun at some places, or circulate it to keep it
liquid,
depending on what temperature you wanted it. Normally, on the night side, yes. Or on the dark side, it would freeze. On the other side, it would try to get hot and vaporize, so you could block it. You'd have to figure out some way to kind of get a balance in there. And this would be more like, I'm more into living systems and ecosystems. So you want to try to build these things like living organisms, because it is hard to try to make, to basically brute force your way through these sorts of things. Like, you want to ship up food, same thing. You want to be able to grow your own food. You want to be able to survive without outside influence from the planet. You might have to get high-tech stuff, but generally you want to probably be able to make most of the things that you need for at least everyday stuff. I'm sorry.
It's a bootstrapping process.
Bootstrapping.
Start with something that lets you build.
Right, and ideally, I personally would want to build like a dome here. And start using permaculture and start doing things that could be used here. Build this technology here before you try to export it. Other people
work on that. That's what they did.
Yes, exactly. And they had some problems too.
But
that's good. They learned a lot.
Just tried again. They really need to try again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
With
I want to try again.
Oxygen enclosure and everything. Try and get it to maintain the amount of oxygen.
Yeah.
Does the biosphere still exist?
Yes. Biosphere 2 was airtight. The Eden Project is not.
Right. That's what I think I can build a small Eden Project dome for $10,000. Seal it up, stay in there for 3 months at a time, see what happens.
The problem of biosphere is not about the energy deficiency, but energy surplus.
Yes, exactly.
So, how to cool the system? Mostly into the winter zone, and when you need some spring and summer, then you can create the locally spring and summer,
mm-hmm.
then go back to winter mode so that the environment become quenched rather than forever exploding into a virus, bacteria, and the plant and the fauna, fauna, all the stuff growing, overgrowing,
right.
and the insect growing. That's the problem. How to take out the energy and hold the state. So it's ideally it will be a protected zone under the Arctic, Antarctic condition. So it should be surrounded by extreme coldness, normal, and then create a strategically and time and space wise modulate that and. Then kill that again, so that you can have a total control over energy program.
Right. Yeah, that's something that, I think you're saying is that there, you have excess energy in space. I mean, it's there's a lot of energy up there, and that's not one of the other reasons to go into space. Actually, they're selling basically, we're the power from space, beam it down to Earth. I mean, so.
I guess two other quick comments here,
sure.
is that it's actually really difficult to do things like land on the moon or land on asteroids and things like that, and it's way easier to land on places that have atmospheres because you can do things like air
braking. Yeah.
Just something to keep in mind. Also, people have recently, within the last 10, 15 years or so, been doing essentially four body problem solutions to getting from one gravity well to another instead of three body problem. That is, for example, within this solar system, taking the sun into account. And so you get really, really, really long travel times, but you can go for about 1/10 the fuel. And so, for example, I think the Japanese did this. Like, their satellite did what it was supposed to do, and they had some extra fuel, and they were like, hey, let's see what we can do. So they, like, did a moon flyby or something with something ridiculously small amount of fuel. Mm-hmm. But with people, it doesn't work so well because you really need radiation shielding. With robots, it's a reasonable trade-off, or at least it can be a reasonable trade-off.
And on the transhumanism,
robots in space instead of yourself.
Well, I think it's a good first step. I'm sorry. But
I was just going to mention on the transhumanism angle. As soon as we figure out how to upload people into computers, we can just send a Coke can-sized chip full of hundreds of people.
I'm a big proponent for telepresence. Keep people in a safe spot, whether it's on Earth or let's say that you had like a sphere that would your radiation shield from, and then you have a robot which is fairly close by that you can basically step into and do sorts of things with. Especially if it's a cheap robot, because you don't care if it gets mangled or whatever.
It doesn't work over long distances.
It doesn't work over long distances until maybe we can figure a way to do quantum entanglement and actually transmit information over a long distance. Basically, send all the bits.
It doesn't work like that.
I don't know. I talked to somebody that actually knew quantum physics, and he said it didn't violate anything. So, but I know. Yeah,
there's like one method somebody had tried and discovered it was theoretically impossible, and maybe they've come up with another one.
Yeah. So.
But the better, easier way to do it would be to rewire your brain to take into account the time lag.
It,
so that,
difficult.
2-hour time lag would seem like an instant job.
It's a bit, I don't like 2 hours.
Yeah, sounds good.
But
it wouldn't seem like 2 hours. It would be like,
slow.
You'd be off for 2 hours.
You just do one thing. Yeah, I don't.
Or parallel process your brain.
Just
make yourself think.
It is already
slowly.
A hugely parallel processor.
I think it was roughly 100 years ago when the original transhumanists, the Russian cosmonists, were thinking about space. One of them came up with a very detailed plan for the exploration of our solar system, and they articulated what you were saying earlier. They said we should. Terraforming comes much later. We'll have result. Their estimation was that fundamental human issues like why do we war would be solved before terraforming.
That's good. I like that.
They said the first thing to do is to get rockets in space, which they did. And then they said we should figure out how to grow plants in space. Because if you grow plants in space and you can get a working ecology in a space station. And I think they did envision inflated structures. They said you want to do that before you get anywhere near a gravity well. So you want to get all over, you want to figure out how to maneuver space from these self-contained, self-persisting, living on the sunlight space blobs. And then you solve world peace and stuff like that, or solar peace, and then you can start thinking about terraforming. I've just been looking here for like 20 minutes. I saw this wonderful paper that explained it all and showed all the steps
that's
and
great.
Stuff. And
yeah.
There's a whole society that's been tracking it for like 50 years. But I can't find it. So.
That does sum it up pretty good. I think that it's a good idea to have this stuff like said open source as much as you can, because then you don't have to reinvent the technology, and then also you don't have to wait for 20 years for somebody's patent to expire before you can use it, or pay several millions and millions of dollars. If somebody makes a really good technology, like let's say like space devs, they got off the shelf components that they're willing to sell for a relatively cheap price. It's worth it. But other times, if you can build your own, they're a lot cheaper. Especially if it's open source, it's a good way to go.
Larry, I have a question for you. Do
sure.
you have Audacity on your computer?
A what?
Audacity.
No, what is that?
It's a recording software, because I have to go.
Okay. No.
Okay.
But
you all should keep going. Will you keep some notes?
I could.
Thank you.
I could wrap most of this up. So.
No, I want you all to keep going and learn and stuff and tell me what happened later.
Okay.
Cool. Okay.
I think, I don't know how to say it.